Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, it's Laura Lynch. Welcome to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. People sometimes like to bet big on technology when it comes to climate change. So, Molly, here's the big question. Can tech save us?
Okay, Laura, way to come in and just hit me with that big question there. Some technologies are really new and shiny and they make all these big promises for climate change. And then others are quietly doing their thing. They're more established. And that's kind of why I'm here, to ask the experts and try and make sense of it all for you.
Well, that's good enough for me. This is What on Earth producer Molly Siegel. And she does have the job of sussing out just how effective all these kinds of technologies are. And we're talking about things like sucking carbon out of the air or blocking the sun's rays, all these other things that are going on to try to mitigate or stop global warming. So, Molly, over to you. Hi.
Hey, Laura.
So, what are you digging into today?
I want to talk about modifying plants at their most basic level, editing their very genes, to deal with one of the biggest climate change problems the world is faced with, drought.
Multiple municipalities have declared agricultural disasters this year, including the county of Stettler and Vulcan County.
The city of Kamloops is now forming a response team to prepare, but a former councillor in that community and farmer says it may be too late for his fields.
Crop yields are, I would say, down in a third of normal type of thing.
Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada says Nova Scotia has been abnormally dry in recent months.
If this continues on, it's going to certainly put a strain on farmers physically, mentally, and financially.
The dry weather is affecting some crops in Atlantic Canada. Central and eastern regions of PEI have had about half the amount of normal rain this season.
That's just some of how farmers were experiencing the effects of drought last year, Laura.
Yeah, and you could hear there, it was a tough growing season. And this year, farmers in many parts of the country are bracing for yet another hot, dry summer.
Oh, yeah. And currently, according to the Canadian Drought Monitor, there's already extreme and severe drought conditions in some parts of British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Northwest Territories, and Manitoba. Last year's drought, of course, affected the growing season and farmers' crops. And Saskatchewan, in particular, was one of those places that did have a very dry season. I chatted with a farmer in the west central region of that province, Devin Longmire.
In 2023, we had around our farm about 50% of what would be a 30-year average moisture. So the last 30 years, on average, we would get about 200 millimeters of rain a year. And this past year, we had about 100, slightly less than that.
Wow, that is a lot less rain than they're used to in a province that's actually pretty dry to begin with. So I'm guessing that made things pretty challenging for him.
It did. But it wasn't just last year. He also explained to me that it's a trend that he's been seeing in more recent years. And of course, this doesn't just have an impact on individual farmers. You know, there's taxpayers that are also footing the bill for this, right? The province of Saskatchewan went from forecasting a budget surplus of about $1 billion to forecasting a deficit of about $482 million. And that is in part because of crop insurance payouts from the drought last year.
That is a lot of money on the line.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of money at stake here because it's not just the crop insurance. Agriculture in general accounted for 7% of Canada's GDP in 2022.
So here we are today. We are talking about gene editing as a solution to drought.
Yeah, and it's front of mind right now, not just because of growing seasons being affected by dry conditions, as we've been talking about. But just last year, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada announced guidelines that allow for gene editing in crop breeding.
All right, let's talk about how this works. Now, just be warned, I'm no scientist, but I want to know, when you talk about gene editing, I think about CRISPR. That's one thing I've heard of. What is CRISPR gene editing technology? Is that an example?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is the most well-known one by far, Laura. And also, for the record, I am not a scientist either. Let's just be clear about that. But here is a little primer for you about how it all works. Okay. So what would become CRISPR was first discovered in bacteria DNA, a defense mechanism that allows the bacteria to identify and cut foreign DNA, like from a virus, into smaller pieces. So because of that, the bacteria then knows what the enemy or the virus looks like in case it strikes again. And what scientists have been able to do is harness this cutting ability quickly and effectively. It can be used to knock out genes or modify how genes are expressed, turning it into a tool that can be used in many different applications. For example, pharmaceutical research, medical treatments, and also to edit crop genomes.
Okay, I actually think I've got it. So that then, for the purposes of what we're doing, is the climate change application?
Yeah. And that's what researchers like Marcus Samuel are hoping for. He's a professor at the University of Calgary, and he's using CRISPR to breed a canola crop that can withstand those dry conditions better.
Canola is quite sensitive to drought. At any stage during flowering or seed filling stage, if there's a drought, this process gets completely affected. So they are quite sensitive.
Oh, canola, why is it so sensitive?
So sensitive because it has a lot of what scientists call biomass. So it's just kind of like a bulky plant that needs a lot of water to grow. And the plant bulks up so that it can produce pods and then seeds. And in that process, there are these critical stages that it goes through. And if there's not enough rain, especially during particular times of its growth, it can be a really big problem for canola.
Like southern Alberta, most of the crops failed last year for canola. And then we are anticipating something similar for this year, too.
And that's where gene editing comes in. Marcus's lab has been using CRISPR to edit the DNA of canola. It started years ago when his lab was doing more basic research on a similar plant. They found a hormone that affects drought tolerance. So now his team has spent the last 4 years applying this knowledge to canola DNA. They use CRISPR to reduce the level of that hormone in canola.
So is it working? Is the plant more tolerant of drought?
So far they've been growing it in the greenhouse, and yeah, so far so good.
So what is it that makes the plant more able to survive dry conditions?
Essentially, it's just a smaller plant.
Probably 20-30% smaller than the unmodified plant, but still produces the same number of flowers, seeds. Therefore, yield from the crop is no different. So therefore, it loses less water to produce the same amount of product.
Well, that sounds like a smart move. The plant is smaller, but still it grows the same amount of seed.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, there has been a lot of controversy over the years over genetically modified food. I'm wondering, is this GMO?
The short answer is not once it's ready. Essentially, researchers like Marcus need to breed out all foreign genes. And that's part of the work that they're doing with the canola plants that they're raising in the greenhouse.
It's in the greenhouse. But what about using it in the field? How close is that to being a reality?
Marcus says probably about 4 or 5 years away before it hopefully can be used on farms, because they have to test it out in real settings, not just in the greenhouse. And there's other hoops they have to jump through too. But if all of the steps work out, Marcus says that it could make a big difference.
This technology will be built in crop insurance in these plants. And if those crops are hit with drought, they can still survive the drought and give you a decent yield. That's what we are hoping for.
Okay, so far, everything you've talked about, it all sounds really promising, but canola is just one crop. Is this technology that can be used anywhere else?
I spoke to Steve Webb. He's the CEO at the Global Institute for Food Security at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, and I asked him that.
Not in Canada, but in Argentina. So they've edited a soybean plant to be more agronomically robust, including drought and some other features as well. From an agronomic traits perspective, which drought would be an agronomic trait, it's Argentina with soybeans. They've developed that technology there.
All right. There's a phrase there that flew right past me. Agronomic trait?
I knew that would be a bee in your bonnet, Laura.
What does it mean?
Basically, it just means that the plant is more resilient to a number of things, including drought. Now, part of the work that the Global Institute for Food Security has been doing is sequencing the genomes of different crops. And that's something that you have to do before you can go in and edit the DNA.
So I think one of the things that's exciting about the gene editing technology platform is the precision that we can make the changes. And the other thing that is exciting about the ability to use gene editing for crop improvement is the fact that we have spent the last 20, 25 years developing all the gene sequencing, and we're understanding like the wheat genome, we're understanding the canola genome, we're understanding the rice genome, we're understanding lots and lots of crops that are really important.
So for instance, the Institute is working on a project in Bangladesh on jackfruit, and sequencing the plant's genome was their first step. More broadly, gene editing is a technology that Steve thinks will become more relevant to agriculture around the world and here at home.
As we enter into more and more dynamic climate changes and the occurrence of drought or flooding, that ability to make precision changes faster is going to be really critical, not just for Canadian farmers and the sustainability of Canadian farmers, both economically, environmentally, and socially, but also we have to recognize that here in Canada, we feed a lot of people around the world.
So what we're talking about here is a world where we're constantly adapting crops as the climate changes.
Yeah, but remember, I mean, that kind of is the story of agriculture throughout history. We've been planting and breeding crops that do well in a particular environment, that suit our own preferences and our needs. Only now we continue to have a growing number of high-tech ways to do that. And gene editing is a relatively new tool in the story of plant breeding.
So do you think farmers would actually use it, though? I'm thinking about the farmer you introduced us to earlier.
Yeah, Devin Longmire. He rotates a bunch of crops, including canola, and he says he's definitely open to new technologies.
I'm always interested in trying new things. And like our farm is always interested in experimenting and trying to see what's coming ahead and trying to get ahead of it. So I would be very interested in any sort of technology that can deal with reduced rainfall.
If, of course, it's cost-effective to do so. So, you know, if there's this product, this drought-resistant canola available, if it works, and if it isn't too expensive when he compares it to the yield it gives, you know, then yeah, he would absolutely try something like that, he says.
I would love to see more money go towards drought-resistant technologies for canola or any other crop. And I mean, if someone was to give me a bag of canola and say, okay, this is going to produce a 30 bushel crop. If you get anything more than 3 inches of rain, 2 inches of rain, I would love to try it.
Okay, but that's the future. We're in the present. What is he doing right now to handle this pattern of less rain he's been seeing?
Well, the part of Saskatchewan that he farms in is known for other crops that already do a little better in drought.
This is a large lentil growing area, and that's in part due to a lower amount of rain that we receive in west central Saskatchewan, or you know, this kind of part of the province. So we're looking at crops that are a bit more drought tolerant, things like lentils, yellow peas, chickpeas.
So as I mentioned, he rotates crops in his fields. And to account for more dry weather, he rotates things like red lentils and yellow peas in more often. But that in itself carries other risks because the yellow peas, the red lentils, they're more sensitive to a lot of rain. And for example, in 2016, he says they had 5 times the average rainfall, and it had a really bad impact on the lentils, but it also had bad impacts on the soil too.
And there is the farmer's lament, right? Just hoping for that really good season. It's a risk no matter what for him, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You're trying to strike that perfect balance, which is difficult, or, you know, if you're growing very disparate crops or crops that have different water requirements, you can't really get a perfect year.
So as Marcus Samuel, the researcher we heard from earlier, says, maybe a gene-edited canola crop can be something like an insurance policy. If you're planting canola anyway, why not insure it against a dry season?
But that just makes me think about one thing. The gene-edited version, what happens if there's a lot of rain?
Yeah, I mean, that was something they were accounting for in breeding this, that it's just as tolerant to rain as a regular canola crop. So you don't lose anything in planting this canola crop. The idea is you would only gain more drought resistance or drought tolerance.
Okay, well then, to recap, let's talk about how much of an impact this gene editing can have on agriculture.
I mean, it definitely seems to have big potential, but it is absolutely not the only way that farmers are thinking about drought and not the only way that researchers are working on drought-tolerant crops specifically. There's many other approaches to doing that, but I think it is fair to say that it is one of many things that could help farmers, the agriculture industry, as well as food security for all of us.
Molly Siegel, thank you for bringing us the story.
You're welcome, Laura.
It's interesting to think about that point that Molly talked about, which is farming has always been about adapting to conditions and trying to make the best of a difficult situation. This is a whole new frontier for that kind of thing. But I imagine that farmers will be ready to take on the challenge if science shows that this actually can be done on a large scale in the fields. And the important thing about this, it's going to try to feed us all, which is a pretty basic thing.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, before we go, we are going to take a crack at answering another one of your climate questions. We hear from a lot of listeners wondering what to do with old stuff made of fabric, things like torn bed sheets, ratty bath towels, stained t-shirts, or
old pajama pants. Once it makes it into the pajama rotation, I feel like it's done.
That's Lindsay Zellett, a listener in Burlington, Ontario.
I'm trying to really think about my footprint. So I was looking at my closet and thinking, what do I do with some of these things? You know, I don't think they're in condition to donate. They might be ripped or stained. What do we do with those? Hopefully the answer is not landfill.
Okay, so should your textiles, should they go into the garbage? Or is there a solution that's better for the climate? What on earth Rachel Sanders decided to find out.
I recently moved house, so I'm thinking a lot about what deserves real estate in my closet. And I'm realizing those mismatched socks and too tight jeans, they gotta go. But what to do with the stuff that doesn't seem to be resellable? Sabine Weber says, don't put it in the garbage.
65% of all the textiles which we found in the garbage were good enough for reuse.
Sabine is a professor at Seneca Polytechnic in Toronto. She studies textile waste.
There's a lot of material going really directly into landfill, and this is extremely sad.
Producing textiles has a climate impact. Clothing and footwear manufacturing make up as much as 10% of global carbon emissions. And when they go to the landfill, they release methane as they decompose. So, what should you do instead of putting it in the garbage?
I usually advise people that they should donate everything if it is dry, clean, and odorless.
Really? Even if it's ripped or stained?
The problem is we as consumers, we don't know what is valuable or what is not valuable.
Sabine says there's a chance that even damaged textiles could find a second life. Here's what happens to your stuff when you drop it in a donation bin.
They are managed by for-profit companies or by charities. They collect this material and they will sell it by the pound.
Charities sell to secondhand stores. Any clothes that don't sell after they've been in a store for a few weeks, and anything that's not sellable at all, like worn-out bedsheets, gets sold to a grader who sorts it all out. The best textiles can end up in markets in other countries. Clothes with stains or holes might get cleaned or fixed there. Sabine visited a market like that in Tanzania last year.
There was a lot of upcycling, tailors and possibilities there. In Tanzania, people don't shop in such luxury malls and retail places. They really go to those secondhand retailers, and they are the main retailers for your clothes. So there is a big demand.
So good quality clothes get resold. More worn out stuff, things like old sheets, might get turned into cleaning rags or shredded and turned into something called shoddy. That's used for things like insulation or carpet underpadding. But then there's material that's in the worst category. Fabric waste that's very poor quality or very dirty. Things that can't be reused. Advocates say that stuff shouldn't be sent to other countries.
That's the stuff that they don't want, and we should not be dumping it there. That really is waste colonialism.
That's Kelly Drennan with the advocacy group Fashion Takes Action. As fast fashion has accelerated, there's more and more low-quality textile waste. You might have seen photos, heaps of clothing in a landfill in Ghana or in the desert in Chile.
There is still a livelihood that relies on our exportation of clothing, so you can't just put on a full stop ban, but we certainly can be sending far less stuff.
So what's the solution? If it can't be reused, can't all of this textile waste be recycled, broken down into basic fibers and turned into new fabric? Well, there's at least one clothing company here in Canada making new clothes out of recycled natural fibers like wool and cotton. But Kelly says we don't recycle textile waste on a large scale because it's expensive to pay people to
sort it, shred it, defiberize it, pre-process it, especially if it's clothing. Bedsheets are easy. Clothing is complicated. It's got buttons and zippers and sequins and three or four different fibers blended together.
The European Parliament says less than 1% of all textiles worldwide are recycled into new products. Kelly says we need to start recycling textiles in Canada, or we need to support fabric recycling in other countries. That could be funded by forcing manufacturers to pay for the costs of recycling their products. The European Union is working on regulations like that right now. Kelly predicts it'll be a few years before we see that kind of policy in Canada. In the meantime, if you're worried about textile waste, she says only buy what you need, invest in good quality, durable goods when you can, take care of your stuff to make it last, and if you're done with it and it's clean, dry, and odorless, donate it. Like I'm doing with my two small jeans and a few odd socks. For What on Earth, I'm Rachel Sanders.
Good on you, Rachel, and thanks for that. We do love to answer your questions, so if you have a climate dilemma in your life, let us know. We have dug into everything from low-carbon weddings to preparing for wildfire evacuations. What do you want help with? Just email us, earth@cbc.ca. And better yet, because, well, honestly, we like to hear things on our program, send us your voice. Send us a voice memo. The email again is earth@cbc.ca. All right, I can't wrap things up without mentioning something. What on Earth has won an award for mental health journalism in Canada. It's for an episode that we first brought you last June. Emily's story, One Activist's Journey Through Climate Anxiety, features Emily Kelsall. She told me about her time in jail, then in hospital in the psychiatric unit, all because of her overwhelming drive to do something about climate change.
So there's kind of like two stories. One story is a story of someone that's trying to take action. And then underneath, there's this dark, I guess, shadow self of someone who's taking actions compulsively, not because they want to and feel that it's the right thing to do, but doing it because they feel like they have to. And if they don't, something bad's going to happen or the blame is on them. I was doing everything I could, but my brain was pressuring me to do more. It got scary.
But as she told me, Emily came through it all with a new perspective on how to make change in this world. Now, we just dropped that podcast again so you can listen if you missed it the first time. Just take a look back at the What on Earth feed. And thank you to the Canadian Journalism Forum on Violence and Trauma for honoring What on Earth and Emily's willingness to tell her story with one of this year's Mindset Awards. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We drop 2 new podcasts every week. And while you're there, leave us a review. We love to read them. But that is all for us today. The show was put together by Andy Mullins, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.